Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, summer school student. One of the former doctoral students of the Pope when he was a university professor and who is one of the participants at his Ratzinger School Circle speaks about his former professor. Rich in relics. Rome abounds with relics, and we look at some of the most popular and most curious objects of veneration in the Eternal City and find out why relics continue to exert such a fascination in our modern times. And the Vatican centuries. Find out how Rome's Castel Sant'Angelo, or Castle of the Holy Angel, got its name by listening to the 9th episode in our series that looks at the lives and legends of the people and places that went into the making of the Vatican. A group of Pope Benedict's former doctoral students are currently meeting in Castel Gandolfo near Rome to discuss Christian mission from an ecumenical perspective. Pope Benedict has convened these annual summer gatherings for many years with some of his former theology students. Each year, the scholars choose a different topic to discuss in depth, and past ones have included issues such as evolution and Islam. The four-day meeting this year is taking place close to the papal summer residence, and Pope Benedict will celebrate Mass and have breakfast with the group on the final day, which is next Monday. One of those former students who has taken part in what has been dubbed the Pope's Summer School is Father Vincent Twomey, an Irish professor of moral theology who has known Joseph Ratzinger for nearly 40 years. He spoke to my colleague Emma McCarthy about what most struck him about his former university professor when he was elected to the papacy.
The only surprise for me was to see him, my professor, as it were, whom I was used to seeing, giving lectures and addressing seminars, suddenly reaching out to people as a pastor. I hadn't experienced that before. Warmly exuding a joy that people could relate to, literally embracing the whole world with his smile and with his evident joy that pervades his life. But even so, for example, I'll never forget the shock when I was in St. Paul's outside the walls the day after he was inaugurated, and there was a reception for the community of Rome. And there, I saw him for the first time kissing babies. Well, now it's very hard to imagine a German professor kissing babies. So that came as a surprise. But otherwise, nothing really that he has written has actually surprised me, except in the sense that everything he reads is a surprise, because you find there's something new, something full of insight. And it's the surprise I expect to get when I read anything that he puts his hand to. He's got the Midas touch. You know, everything he looks at turns to gold, in the positive sense that anything he writes about, be it a fresco in an ancient church, be it a philosophical analysis of a modern philosopher or contemporary theologian, it just simply has that extraordinary spark of originality, which, as a result of which, one is always surprised, because he reveals to you aspects of a question that you really weren't expecting to find out about.
That was Father Vincent Twomey, a former doctoral student of Pope Benedict, talking to Emma McCarthy. A fragment from the True Cross. A nail from the crucifixion, the blood-stained bandage of Padre Pio, the skull of St. Agnes, and the finger of St. Thomas the Doubting Apostle. These are just some of the examples of the incalculable array of relics that can be found in Rome or elsewhere in Italy. Relics have been venerated since the very earliest days of Christianity and are divided in three classes, with the highest class reserved for those relics that are actually a physical part of the saint, such as a bone or a hair. A second class relic is something owned by a saint, whilst the third-class one is an object that has touched a first- or second-class relic. Contrary to what many people believe, the Catholic Church does not claim that relics have magic or special powers, but rather sees them as a way to come closer to a person who was deemed holy and thus form a closer bond with God. And despite our modern high-tech society, relics continue to enjoy great popularity among people of all ages and all countries. This was shown very clearly after the death of Pope John Paul, when there was a massive demand from the faithful for acquiring fragments from one of his cassocks, despite the fact that he is not yet a saint. But why do relics exert such a fascination, even amongst non-believers? And is the veneration of relics a macabre superstition, as many modern Christians claim? Well, to find out more about Rome's treasure trove of relics and to get the answers to those questions, I spoke to Liz Lev, an expert on Christian art and archaeology at Duquesne University's Rome campus.
Well, I think the interest in relics is something that every human being can one way or another relate to. I mean, you remember the first flower your husband gave you, you remember your lock of hair of your child from the first haircut, or even, you know, in a very modern sense, you have something like the Hard Rock Cafe, where you have these instruments, these objects that belong to people that we've admired or enjoyed or derived pleasure from. So the idea of holding on to a moment in time or to a person is a very universal sentiment.
Nonetheless, there are many modern Christians who claim that this veneration of relics is a macabre superstition. What's your answer to that?
Well, it's a funny division. It seems that if you're making a keepsake of an object just for memory's sake, everybody accepts that as perfectly normal, even if it's an autograph of a television star from a series that's long been off the air. But when we talk about an object that somehow links to a supernatural presence, the object of someone who, a belonging of a person who lived on earth historically and that we now know is in heaven, it's that supernatural factor that seems to put off, frighten, startle, or discombobulate even many people who are very grounded in a rational, scientific view of Christianity.
Nonetheless, it should be remembered also, in fact, that the Church itself doesn't claim that relics have magic powers, does it?
Well, the Church has never claimed that relics have magic powers simply because magic is something that is always controlled by man. What we talk about always in the Church, we don't believe in magic in the Church. We believe in the grace of God. We believe in that which God is capable of doing, and particularly through the saints who have followed his will, lived in his grace, and led these exemplary lives. And so to have an object, something that links us to this person who lived an incredible life and made it to heaven, that idea is what the Church promotes.
Now, another popular misconception, although of course it did happen in the past, is that relics cannot be sold. There is actually a canon law, isn't there, governing their treatment?
Well, in the post-fall world, once you have something that is attractive to people and that people desire, immediately there will be abuses of the question. So we find the earliest church fathers dealing with false relic sellers. We have St. Augustine warning about characters who are running around selling bones, animal bones as relics. And it's been a long-standing problem in the church to try to eradicate people who take advantage of people's desire for relics, either by selling them — relics are not to be sold — or purporting completely false objects as relics. And as more people began to take interest in the cult of the relics, obviously more abuses took place. And ultimately, we have several moments in the history of the church, particularly in the councils of Trent, when a simple ban on sale of relics, any form of, quote, filthy lucre, should not be attached to them. And then we find even in canon law today that it is absolutely forbidden and wrong to sell relics.
Despite it all, there's a lot of popularity. These relics have an amazing popularity, and we've seen that even over the last few years, and when there was this massive interest in obtaining threads from one of Pope John Paul's cassocks.
Oh, well, yes. In the particular case of John Paul II, or another very good case of this, is Padre Pio. The interest in relics of Padre Pio is immense. But in the case of John Paul II, whom we all know will become a saint, and this desire, this wait, this eager anticipation for the day when we can all celebrate the canonization of John Paul II and see the church recognize him in heaven, there's already this anticipation and getting little bits, sort of being ahead of the game, if you will, kind of getting into the advanced sales before Christmas, if you will. So getting these little objects, these little pieces of his cassock to be able to feel closer to this historical presence. If you think about it, how many people met John Paul II? How many people knew John Paul II? How many people's lives were affected by John Paul II? And now, how many lives will be affected by John Paul II's intercession in heaven? And so having that little channel, that little object that is part of his earthly presence, that somehow allows one to feel close to his heavenly presence. These things have been exploding. The request for relics for John Paul II has turned into thousands upon thousands upon thousands in these last few years.
Now, you mentioned there, Padre Pio, that there was the viewing of his body this year. And then back in 2002, there was a bandage with bloodstains from his stigmata that was brought to Rome for the first time, which attracted an amazing amount of interest among the faithful, didn't it?
A tremendous amount. My memory of the arrival of the relics of Padre Pio in Rome was that the relic of the glove went to a church up outside the city, not a very big church, not very big enclosure. And obviously expecting there to be a few curious, interested people in this day and age, a few faithful. And the church found itself overwhelmed with visitors, spilling out in the street, causing traffic on Via Aurelia. The amazing response of people to come and see this remain of the stigmata, I mean, our stigmatist of the 20th century. Really, it's remarkable how, even though it seems that we want to push away this notion of supernatural, and yet there are millions upon millions of people who are still interested and want to feel close to this phenomenon, which is outside the realm of our eyes and our touch.
Well, let's turn to Rome now, which of course is a city that's particularly rich in relics. For instance, the Holy Cross in Jerusalem Basilica, this has an amazing collection, fragments of the real cross, a nail used in the crucifixion, two thorns from the crown of thorn of Jesus, to name just a few.
Right. It's a very important site for remembering very specifically the Passion of Christ. And looking at those relics, which are displayed in a marble room with a sort of coldish atmosphere to it, completely lined with marble, and you feel as if you're in a tomb. And against the far wall, you have the cross of the wood of the cross, the piece of the headboard, the nails, the thorns, this accumulation of objects that remind us of the very real historical and human suffering of Christ. And it's a very good way to close that gap between that day in 33 AD and our day today by realizing, you know, this really happened.
And I read that the hearts of many past popes, and indeed other internal organs, are stored at the Church of Saints Vincent and Anastasius near Rome's Trevi Fountain. Why is that?
Well, one always hopes to be fortunate enough to live in an era of a sainted pope. And in preparation for that, I think the church already prepares itself for relics. We have the cassock of John Paul II ready to go. We had the hearts of these great popes. And so something always there so that we can connect ourselves back to these historical figures even as time passes by.
That's also, I read the relics of many other, perhaps not quite so well-known figures, like Saint Agnes, the martyr, her skull. That's got quite an interesting story, her life is, and her martyrdom, right?
Saint Agnes. Well, Saint Agnes is one of our great Roman martyrs. I mean, she's a great martyr for a number of reasons. One, because she was a young girl. She was the sort of person in Roman society of the 4th century AD. Nobody would have given her a chance. She was destined for marriage. She had no particular authority, and yet she found in herself the strength through cooperating with the grace of God and her faith to defy the Roman Empire. And her long, drawn-out martyrdom, flames, attempted rape, attempted humiliation, and ultimately the decapitation shows how this young woman resisted and resisted and resisted. She's a magnificent martyr. And where did all this happen? It happened in the heart of downtown Rome, in everyone's favorite sitting room, the Piazza Navona. So in that same site where today we get ice cream, we take our pictures, we enjoy seeing the painters working, is that site where this brutal, brutal witness to faith on the part of this young woman. And her relics in particular, I mean, her church, her catacombs, the catacombs where she's buried, were so inspirational that the emperor's own daughter wanted to be buried by St. Agnes, so Costanza, the daughter of Constantine. So we've seen in her case, and in the case of many other martyrs, our Lawrence, our Cecilia, these tremendous witnesses to touch that memory is always a very stimulating thing, even to the Romans today.
You mentioned earlier, of course, the duplications, the counterclaims, the claims, the fact that so many relics being sold down the history were false or likely to be false. Can you think of some of the most glaring false relics, the most notorious cases?
Well, there have been some pretty wild claims for relics. I believe there was some of the darkness from one of the plagues of Egypt, which was kept in a church in Rome for a while. There was the foreskin of Christ, apparently was a relic kept in several different places.
Although I read that the Vatican was unhappy about this particular veneration and forbade any mention of it.
These are a number of kind of over-the-top creations of relics that came about during the years. There are some relics that have been seriously questioned, not least of which is the fragment of the column in Santa Prassede. It has been called into question for many, many years because it doesn't appear in history until the 12th century, when it happens to be the family of the Colonna, which means column, that crop up with the column of Christ. So some of these things are more than a little bit suspicious.
And sometimes the sheer quantity, I mean, for instance, the fragments of the real cross, sometimes you must wonder whether all of them are genuine.
We are not the first to wonder about the extraordinary number of fragments of the true cross. And as a matter of fact, the people who first seriously began to question the authenticity of all the fragments of the true cross claimed to be in various places around the world were the Bollandists, who were formed in the late 16th, early 17th century. And they set upon themselves to catalog all the relics in the world with a particular interest in the fragments of the true cross. To date, they have not found enough pieces to make a single cross.
That's interesting. Okay. Finally, what's your favorite or most inspirational relic, if you could tell us, and why?
My favorite relic in Rome is in the Church of the Holy Cross of Jerusalem, built by St. Helena in the 4th century AD. It's right there with all the other objects of the Passion, the true cross, the nails, the thorns. It's the finger of St. Thomas, the finger that a doubting Thomas insisted that he would not believe in the resurrection of Christ until he put that finger in Christ's side and felt his wounds with it. And I think that relic is a very good way of understanding our relationship to relics in the church, in that Thomas, like a normal human being, wants to use his senses to understand. He wants to see, he wants to touch, he wants to feel, he wants to know empirically. And Jesus understands it without even Thomas even having to ask him. Jesus approaches him and tells him to feel with his own hands the wounds. Christ understands our doubts and our uncertainties. But at the same time, as Thomas verifies with his own eyes and says, "My Lord and my Savior," Jesus reminds him, "You have seen and you have believed, Thomas, but blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe." And I find that a very good way to go through the question of relics.
I was speaking there to Liz Lev, an expert on Christian art and archaeology in Rome. We now broadcast the 9th episode or chapter in our ongoing historical series, where we look at the lives and legends of the people and places that went into the making of the Vatican throughout the centuries.
The programme is written by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett, and we are running an episode each Saturday. Today's episode is called Between Two Epochs and focuses on the figure of Pope Gregory the Great, who introduced plain chant and did much to help the poor and needy.
The last Western emperor had been deposed and the imperial insignia sent to Constantinople. Italy was under the barbarians.
From the Ostrogoths it was won back briefly by the Byzantine government, but then it fell again, this time to the Lombards, who held sway for nearly two centuries.
In that time they managed to dismember the unity of the country and retard its development. But while Roman civilization had crumbled, a new power had been growing in its place.
That power was the papacy.
During the reign of Pope Symmachus, from 498 to 551, the stairs and atrium of the Vatican Basilica were brought to completion, and the rotunda was dedicated to St. Andrew. Symmachus also placed walls with projecting roofs at the two extremities of the steps to protect the pilgrims from the burning sun as they ascended the steps on their knees.
Pope Gregory the Great, who reigned from 590 to 604, gave new impetus and fervour to the liturgy and carried out an important liturgical adaptation in St. Peter's. During the Vatican excavations in the 1940s, it was discovered that Constantine had not actually built an altar, he'd simply placed his monument over Peter's tomb.
Since a permanent altar was an indispensable element in Christian basilicas, Pope Gregory attempted to resolve the problem by raising the presbytery floor so that the upper part of the monument could be used as an altar. Below this, he built a crypt so that pilgrims could still approach the tomb. This they did by walking through a curved gallery, following the walls of the apse, and then walking through another on their way out.
The galleries were extended from the centre of the apse to the back of Constantine's monument. Later on, another altar was placed in the crypt for liturgical celebrations.
Gregory also brought new life to the basilica by starting a school of cantors. He wanted to form musicians who, through the universal language of music, would help him to spread Christianity outside Italy, in countries where Latin was not spoken. One of the centres of the school was under the steps of St. Peter's, the other was under the building of the Lateran. For a long time, various relics of this school were preserved at the Lateran. One of these was the couch on which Gregory rested as he sang, another the whip which he brandished at inattentive choir boys.
Gregory collected all the most beautiful Christian songs into an antiphonary. He then attached this with a golden chain to the chair of Peter.
Gregory was responsible for regulating the services and ritual of the church, and his reform and standardization of plain chant made his name a household word. He raised church music to a level it had never before known, and to this day, Gregorian chant can be heard in Benedictine monasteries all over the world.
Gregory the Great was born in Rome about 540 of a noble Roman family. As a young man, he went into civil administration, and by his early 30s was already prefect of Rome. But on his father's death, Gregory distributed a third of his wealth to the poor, and with the rest he founded six monasteries. He turned his own house into a monastery, and his mother, Sylvia, lived in a cell nearby and grew vegetables for the monks.
It was while he was a monk there on the Caelian Hill that Gregory took a walk one day through the Forum and saw the fair-haired English boys for sale as slaves. Not Angles, but Angels, was the historic remark of Gregory's, to become so well known to every English schoolchild. One of Gregory's fellow monks was that same Augustine, whom he was to send years later to convert the English.
To this day, much of Gregory's monastery can still be seen, including a legendary table at which, we're told, the saint used to serve daily 12 poor men, and on one occasion, 13. The extra guest was a visiting angel.
But Gregory was not to enjoy the contemplative life for long. In 579, Pope Pelagius II sent him as papal nuncio to Constantinople. And when Pelagius died in the year 590, Gregory was unanimously elected his successor. He was most reluctant to accept, but the people acclaimed him, and the emperor confirmed the choice. It was to prove a wise one.
Gregory was a man of wide vision and great practical ability. He played a leading part in the Christianization of Europe, reconciled Spain to the faith, and abolished simony among the clergy of Gaul. In Italy, he worked for the conversion of the Lombards, who were Arians, and the year before he died, he was rewarded when they capitulated en masse to the Catholic faith. But together with his missionary zeal, Gregory possessed a high sense of justice, and under his pontificate, the Jews were protected from persecution.
Gregory's time was a very unhappy period for Rome, and it was generally thought that the end of the world was not far off. The city itself was decimated by the bubonic plague. Pelagius had died of it. Gregory took action before he was even consecrated pope. He ordered 40 processions to make their way through the city to intercede for God's help.
Men and women, priests and children, marched through the streets, many of them falling dead by the wayside. Just as the pope was about to enter St. Peter's, he saw a vision of the Archangel Michael on the summit of Hadrian's tomb. The angel was in the act of sheathing his sword. From that moment, the pestilence ceased. A chapel was built on the spot where the angel had appeared, and from that day the tomb was known as Castel Sant'Angelo, or the Castle of the Holy Angel.
Although Pope Gregory had taken for himself the title Servant of the Servants of God, a title to be adopted by all future popes, he lived at a time when the pope was not allowed to be only the Bishop of Rome, a pastor of souls. He was expected to be civil administrator and general of the troops. The church built hospitals, orphanages, homes. Daily the pope distributed bread to the starving masses. To the poor and sick he sent food to the door. To the impoverished nobles he gave wine, grain and vegetables. Gregory took particular interest in the conditions of the peasants, who were literally slaves of the soil, and helped to free them from this dependence.
The city was still in a bad way, for the plague had been followed by famine, and the famine by a storm that had blown down trees, houses and churches. Last of all came the Lombards, and once again it was the Pope who had to make peace with the invader. Gregory the Great has been described as the last of the Roman popes and the first of the medieval popes. Certainly his stature is such that the image of Gregory as a bridge between two epochs is not too far from the truth. When he died, they wrote on his tomb, "The Consul of God."
Gregory the Great was the most prolific writer and left many homilies, letters, and the history of his pontificate in 14 books. His writings are important sources for church and profane history of the time.
The times are very sad. The fields desolate and deserted, the cities empty. The Senate is dead, the people no longer exist. The sword hangs over the heads of those who are left. We are in the midst of the ruin of the world.
The programme was written by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. Well, that's all from Vatican Radio's English programme for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. Laudato Jesus Christus.